Today's text is John chapter 9, verses 1 through 41. Hear now the word of the Lord. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, and I wash and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight, until they called the parents of the man who had received the sight and asked them, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know. Nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" You got to love that. And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses. But as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "This is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and you would teach us?" And they cast him out. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, I want to give you a few things to think about so you remember that the sermon's for all of us, right? We all need to hear from God, And the Bible is important for all of us, so I want to give you some things to think about too, okay? Some of you know my little daughter, Emmy, right? Well, when she was 2, she used to love to play a game. She would try to throw a blanket over her head so she couldn't see, and then she would try to run as fast as she could across the room. And she thought it was kind of fun that she didn't know what was going on. And do you think that was a safe game for her to play? What do you think probably happened when she would do that? Hit her head on stuff a lot, right? Yeah. She'd run into stuff, and for some reason she would get up laughing and do it again. Little kids are crazy, aren't they, right? But it's not safe to run around when you can't see, right? You don't know what you might trip over or run into, and I'm thankful that she never got really hurt. But, you know, especially if you were going to walk around outside, you'd get really hurt if you can't see, right? What if you walked into the street, right? A lot of dangerous stuff could happen. It's not safe to walk around when you can't see. Well, today's story talks about all of us being blind and that we need Jesus to open our eyes. What do you think that means? It doesn't mean our actual eyes, because you all can see, right? God's been very kind. He's given all you guys eyes that work. He means that our hearts can't see. That's kind of maybe a weird thing to think about, right? That your heart can't see. Your heart just pumps blood, right? Well, he means the way that we think about things when he says our heart. And what Jesus means is that none of us think about Jesus the way we should unless he comes and helps us and kind of opens the eyes of our heart, the Bible says. And know what? None of us, unless Jesus comes to us and helps us believe, we wouldn't believe because our hearts don't like to think that we're sinful, right? Sometimes you hear yourself saying, I'm not that bad. I'm better than other people. Do you ever think that kind of stuff? I think that stuff sometimes too. And that's thinking like a blind heart, the Bible says. But when Jesus lets us see the truth, we see, I have to have Jesus save me because I'm not good enough to go to heaven. Sinful people don't get to go to heaven. But if Jesus dies for them, they do. And he died for everyone who believes, right? So all you have to do is believe in Jesus, and he saves us. And then you're able to see what he did for you and believe it. That might be hard to think about, but I want you to try, okay, as we go through the rest of the sermon, all right? All right, thank you for listening. This is a favorite story for many of us and for good reason. But I think a lot of times we miss the point of what's really being communicated. And thank you, sir. And if any of you were in Brad's Sunday School today, I actually dovetailed really nicely with what we're talking about today. A lot of times we want to just look at some dazzling thing Jesus did and just be like, wow, that would have been so cool to see. Well, he really showed you he was God by that, didn't he? And, well, sure, it would have been neat to see. And yeah, that's, the story says unless he was from God, he couldn't have done those things. But John, particularly, whenever he is showing us a miracle that Jesus does, it's because it's supposed to teach us a much bigger point. And the much bigger point here, thank you very much, sir. The much bigger point is not a very subtle one. It's pretty easy to see. What have we been hearing from Christ for several, through the Apostle John, through several chapters now? That he is the light of the world. And again, we're still here around the Feast of Tabernacles. We don't know exactly when this story happened, but it's very much connected to what we've been hearing. That in this Feast of Tabernacles, when they had this big festival of lights, that Jesus comes and says, I am the light of the world. And so now John gives us a very hands-on, tangible example of what he's been explaining. And he points out two things. One, look what happens when the light shines on you. Look what happens when he enables you to see. And the flip side is, look what happens when you reject that light and choose blindness instead. So it's very important. He kind of takes it from out here in the ether. Yes, he's the light of the world, and lots of prophecies talking about that. And he very compassionately, I think, for our weak faith, zooms way in here and says, let me give you an example. Let's talk about what the light does to people who were once blind. And then look what happens if you reject that light and choose to remain in blindness. This is the sixth of the seven signs that John gives us. And again, very important each time, often attached to a Jewish festival or just the city of Jerusalem and pointing out their death, their state of blindness, their state of having no joy. These things are always contrasted. Here's the state of Christ, of you without Christ, And here is the state of those who are with Christ, who have him, thanks to his mercy. And so, we have this beautiful story, and very colorfully recorded for us. And so we have right away this very temporary, very trivial view of life and the way the Jews worked. Again, they were so tied to, if I do the right thing, I get a blessing. If I do the wrong thing, I don't. And if I can just figure out how to do the right things, I'll be fine, which is why the gospel here is not making sense to them. And so we even see the disciples operating according to that way of thinking. They see this blind man, and they say, he's blind. Well, someone did something wrong. Was it him or his parents? Because life's about doing the right things so you get good things and avoiding bad things so you don't have anything bad happen to you. And Christ says, well, it's neither one. This happened that my glory might be displayed in him. And while I don't think that we are probably as tied to this way of thinking about what happens if we do wrong things or if something's bad happening to me, why, I think it is in all of us, and it's very much in our culture. It's very much in human nature. And Galatians 4 actually calls that way of approaching God pagan. It's a pagan way of approaching God. And you look at the pagan religion, what do? Do the right sacrifices, buy off this god, and your crops will go well. Make the gods a little bit angry because you did the wrong thing. Well, then you're going to lose the next battle. Your country fights it. And again, I don't think you're out there offering little trinkets of who knows what to God in your backyard because you need a promotion at work. But you do it in your heart, I think. I'm not saying I have specific suspicions of any one of you doing this kind of thing. I know I do it. I ruin times of blessing wondering, what cards can I play to keep this going? Instead of realizing, I don't deserve it at all in the first place, so I obviously didn't play any card to get this. It's just God's grace. Why don't you sit back and enjoy it instead of ruining it with your calculations? And I know many of you, in talking with some of you, in times of suffering, it's so tempting to go down the road of, what lessons have I not learned yet? And if I could just figure this out, then this heavy hand will be lifted from me. And that's not why we go through these things. There are sometimes painful consequences that we're in where you can draw a straight line back to a sin you did, all right? Why am I in traction? I got drunk and drove. That's why, okay? Straight line, okay? But why have I been inflicted with this cancer? Why did my spouse up and decide and cheat on me? Why was my child taken from me? Sometimes there is no earthly answer we are given to those things. And you will drive yourself mad trying to find the answer because God hasn't given it to you. Is God teaching us in all situations? Yes. There's lessons to be learned in the good and the bad. He's always teaching us something. So don't hear me saying when you're going through a tough time, God's got nothing to teach you. He's got mountains of things to teach us. But don't try to learn the narrow lesson of, okay, you know, my whole department got laid off. What sin did I commit to get this here? Well, I mean, unless you embezzled everything and drove the country, drove your company into bankruptcy, there probably isn't something you did. It's the consequence of living in a sin-broken world. But God is always teaching us through these things and often is giving us a way to cling to him all the more. But don't drive yourself crazy with this kind of pagan, temporary kind of mentality that just says, acts like God works with karma, okay? That is so far from the way our sovereign and providential God works. And they need their eyes open here to what's going on. Said, no one sinned, and because they said these mean things, did this wrong thing, now their son's struck with blindness. And God does not do that. God enabled him, God providentially put him in a place where he had a difficult providence to bear for however many years he was blind. And then gave him the wonderful providence of having those eyes opened. Not just to give him open eyes, but to teach all of us for thousands of years to come what kind of a God he is. And so Christ says, we have to do this. Okay, God has prepared, he sent me to do these works, and we must do them while it's still day. Why we still have daylight? This is because night is coming and we can't work anymore. What does he mean by that? He's not talking about the end of all things, when after he has saved all people, then you're permanently in whichever place you belong, for those who reject him in hell, for those who have been saved by him in heaven. He's not talking about that. He's talking about there is a unique window of time, particularly for the Jewish people, where he is here ministering to them, and he knows what's been prophesied for them, that the bulk of them are going to reject him and will be blinded to turning toward him as punishment for their rejection. And that is the night that is coming. And so what you see, a merciful, and don't misinterpret what I'm saying here as though it's not divine, a merciful desperation on Christ's part here. Night's coming. I have a limited amount of time to get this message out before darkness is going to fall on these people. And he doesn't say that lightly. We see elsewhere when he looks at the Jerusalem that is going to reject him, he knows it's going to happen. He weeps over it. Not because he isn't sovereign, not because some other forces are out there working that he can't control. It's because he is too wonderful for us to understand. And his sovereign plan is going to happen, and his sovereign plan included that these people who were going to reject him were going to be blinded for it spiritually. And he's weeping over that. And that is hard for us to understand. Because the cynic in you says, why don't you wipe your tears away and plan something else for crying out loud if you don't like it? Obviously, that is a blasphemous thought. And we don't know why he is doing these things, why he's chosen to glorify himself the way that he does. He doesn't always reveal those things to us. But we know that this idea, that this desperation on Christ's part is not in lack of faith to what his father's done. It's not in disagreement with his father's plan. He's not saying, oh, I wish my father had planned something different. I got to get this done before it's all too late and I'm crying about it. No. He's the one pronouncing judgment. He's the one telling them, you're children of the devil. Why won't you turn? The father does the same thing throughout the Old Testament in Ezekiel. He says, why will you choose death? I don't take pleasure in it. Why won't you choose life? And we see that as sovereign as our father is, and he is sovereign over all things, there's nothing outside his power. Somehow in his sovereignty, he has also given us the ability and power to make our own choices, and no one makes our choices for us. Are they all part of God's plan? Yes. Do you still make your own? Yep. Has anyone forced you to make a choice against your will? No. Your will is your choice maker, right? You heard me say this before. The phrase free will is redundant. Either you have a will or you don't, okay? Either you make choices or you don't. If something else or someone else is making your choices for you, you don't have a will at all, right? You know you always do what you want. You're not thrilled with your options sometimes. But we are not all of a sudden, you know, these walking robots must do what has been programmed. No, we always make our own choices. And what we see here, God is pleading with sinful people. Repent. And they in their hardness of heart say, no. And what God says is there's going to be a time coming when I'm going back to heaven and blindness will descend on you, my people, because of your rejection. So repent before it's too late. Very merciful desperation on Christ's part to get this out while there's still time. So in verse 6, we see what Christ is going to do to demonstrate what's going on while there's still day. And so much different imagery with light and darkness, blindness and sight playing on here. It's very, very powerful. And so Jesus' method of healing is maybe a little unconventional. And he spits on the dust enough to make some mud, makes it into two mud cakes, and smears it on the guy's face, right over his eyes. And that's actually a little less, perhaps, shocking to us than some of his other methods. I mean, in Mark 7, he just comes up to the blind man and spits right on his eyes. To the man who's deaf and mute, sticks his fingers in his ears, and then somehow gets spit onto the guy's tongue. We don't even know how. Why is this a recurring theme, you may ask? I don't think we're given exact definitions for why the saliva, okay? But we do know that in that culture, there's a lot of crazy superstition that saliva or blood had crazy magical healing powers. And then there was a Jewish spin on that that said, while blood or saliva is one that makes one unclean and cannot be dealt with, if it's the blood or saliva of a very powerful, pious person, it could actually make something clean. None of those are true, okay? None of those are true, okay? So don't hear Christ condescending to that. But it's more the idea of what he is saying by demonstrating this, like he does with other rituals, like the trials by water and fire. Those are actual legitimate ways to judge whether someone is a criminal or not. But God comes into those kind of cultural milieus and says, you think this happens? Let me kick it up and actually show you something that's really true. So see Christ saying, okay, you think that the power of someone can make saliva or blood into something clean? You think that? Well, check this out then, okay? Watch what I do. It's going to blow all your categories up, okay? And so he puts these on, he makes this saliva mud pack, puts it on the man's eyes and says, go to Siloam. Again, tying this to what? The Feast of Tabernacles, where they would get the water, which symbolized the rivers of living water. So here you have the light and the water bound together in one beautiful sign. And then John goes out of his way to say, by the way, Siloam means sent. And whenever John does that, if God is inspiring someone to go out of the way to explain something, it's always a clue that, hey, we should probably figure out why. And what he wants to make clear through that is that don't think for a second that this saliva has magical power and made him clean. And people used to think the pool of Siloam had healing powers. He goes, don't think that Siloam is healing this guy. He just said in verse 4 that I am the one, I got to do the works of the one who sent me. I'm the sent one. And so he says, go to Siloam where the sent one from God will make you be able to see. It's all the wonderful imagery that God uses of our salvation. You have so many pictures coming together, right? You have blindness receiving sight. You have water washing away filth. All at the proclamation of God himself. And was the blind man seeking Christ in this situation? Christ sees him in a state of blindness, has mercy on him, and goes to him and says, I will bring you sight. Only from me do you get this. And again, I mean, since John chapter 3, actually since John chapter 1, this idea of light being tied to the life and darkness and blindness being tied to death has been a big theme here. So a lot of things are coming together here in one amazing sign. And Christ is demonstrating here, all of Jerusalem, you are lost in blindness slash darkness slash death. There's one way out. If the Son comes to you and says, see, that I cover you, that I wash you, and then you receive sight slash light slash life. And so I love the very understated way that the Bible says this. He went, washed, came back seeing. And we can get accustomed to the fact that this is one of more Jesus' more common miracles because he seems to heal this ailment in humanity more than anything else in the New Testament. But there's nowhere else. The man's words are not inaccurate. Nowhere in the entire Old Testament is anyone who's been born blind do they receive sight. The only time we see sight returning in the Old Testament is when God struck people with blindness and then lifted it. But someone being born blind has never happened. And so you see everyone rightly up in arms about it. How in the world did this happen? And they're rightly shocked, wondering, is this actually the guy who was born blind? Is it someone who looks like him? And of course the Pharisees are incredulous, like, he was never blind. Well, they can't argue with the parents. Yeah, he was. And then we see that this healing of the blind man is really mirroring with almost uncanny similarity the healing of the lame man. So you recall back in chapter 5, it was also in Jerusalem on the Sabbath, also by another pool, this time at the pool of Bethesda. So here we have healing on the Sabbath by the pool of Siloam. And while there are great similarities, there are vast differences, okay? Same thing, Pharisees, how dare this man heal on the Sabbath? Who cares if it was a miraculous sign? It can't be from God because this man broke the Sabbath, meaning our definition of the Sabbath, not God's. In the same situation, Christ came to the lame man as he came to the blind man, reaching out to them. But the response is what is hugely different. The lame man responds by saying, I don't know, it's that guy over there. I'm going to save my own skin here. I'm going to throw my lot in with this guy, even though he gave me the ability to walk after 30 years of lameness. I don't care. My heart is hard. I'll take what I can get from you, but I have no desire to worship you. And here we have this man, even his own parents, like, oh, you ask him. They're playing the lame man's card from chapter 5, distancing themselves from Christ. When it says being put out of the synagogue, that's what they feared. That's true on full on excommunication here. And that is, because of their culture, a far more culturally significant event than it would be for us today. Don't hear me read differently spiritually. Excommunication is a very powerful thing that God has given us to keep us from going off the rails. It's a way of not letting us enjoy our attempts to get off the ranch, as it were, and making us desire to return. We can hear that comfort of the gospel again. So don't hear me saying that it was more significant spiritually back then. But that culture was so united around this, and it was a shame culture at that. If you're put out of the synagogue, it's time to move to a new town. You're done. You're done here. You'll never work in this town again. And so they're rightly afraid of this, but for the wrong reasons. Okay. And their son doesn't care. He is so grateful for what's been done. And you see, it's not just for the temporary sight. When Christ says to him, "Do you want to believe in the Son of Man?" So yeah, because I want to worship that guy. I want to worship that guy. He's already been thrown out of the synagogue. Okay, he's already received that excommunication. It doesn't matter. He has set his sights on what is eternal. He gets what has been done for him. And if he's put out of the synagogue, so be it. Because that kind of earthly punishment, that kind of earthly suffering does not compare, to use Paul's words in Romans 8, of the glory that will be revealed in us, thanks to Christ. And so we see, as the Pharisees begin to question them here, there's a real play on blindness here. It's a real obvious play on the term. We see one that was physically blind now receives sight. They who actually can see physically are as spiritually blind as you could be. And the first thing they're blind to is, again, just like in chapter 5, they're blind to what the Sabbath is about. It's about resting ultimately in what God would do for us. Not all this list of all kinds of man-made rules that they had established as fences around the Sabbath. And one of those rules, you're forbidden to knead dough, okay? So his kneading of the mud was one of their invented rules. So he's broken the Sabbath, and also they had a problem just healing somebody, okay? And so they're claiming he's the real sinner here. And you gotta love the call it courage, call it moxie, call it just strong faith is what I'd prefer, of the blind man. Obviously, he's been a beggar. He has no social standing. He couldn't have less social standing. He's only been seeing for the last few minutes. And he's taking on the whole synagogue authority structure. Not because he's fighting his own battle. He's defending the Messiah. But you got to love his boldness. And yes, that was very tongue-in-cheek. Why do you want to learn so much about this guy? Do you want to become his disciples? And then his boldness. I don't know whether he's a sinner or not. I don't care. That's saying he might be one. He's saying, that is so far from my concern. I am focusing on what I know. I can see now. And if this guy was the sinner you're claiming, God would not do works through him. And so you got to love his, well, here's a curious thing line there. You know, is what they kept saying, we know this man can't come for God. We know what Moses says, all right? Because really, well, you know a whole lot, but apparently the huge elephant in the room you can't see. This man, clearly from God, restored my sight, something that's never been done in the history of the world, and you're scratching your head as far as where he comes from. Because this is truly outrageous. And they get his point. You're presuming to teach us. Yes, he was. And they got an F minus, okay? They got a clearly, what they're doing, what the story is doing is unfolding. Do you see how many layers there are to spiritual blindness? And how it makes us do the most irrational things. And the text shows you, it brings to a head, what is the crux of their blindness? What's really their problem? And they've said it before, and they say it again now. We are disciples of Moses. We know God spoke through him. This guy, no way. And what's the big deal about being a disciple of Moses? He was a good guy, right? And Ten Commandments, they're pretty worthwhile to follow. What's wrong with being a disciple of Moses? Problem is, Moses pointed ahead to Christ. And they're refusing to see that. But back in chapter 5, when we had this, again, identical kind of situation with the healing of the lame man, Christ said to them in verse 45, "Do not think that I will accuse you before the Father. There is one who will accuse you, though. Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" What's this What's the issue here? Moses was, again, the one, the mediator God put the old covenant in place with. He received God's words on the mountain. He told Israel, if you obey these 613 laws, you can keep this land and you'll get rich on it. Your enemies won't ever oppress you. If you break it, though, I become your enemy, and I'll kick you out and throw you into exile. I know we went over this a lot when we were doing the book of Joshua. What was the whole point of a covenant like that? When you know they're going to break it. God knows they're going to break it. God even prophesied in the old law they would break it and go into exile. Well, can't you save us all the trouble and just not do this? Well, his point was to show what? The whole world. This makes sense to you. Earning a place in my kingdom makes sense to you. So I want you to take a look at what kind of shot you have at earning a place in my kingdom. Israel is you, okay? Let's see how well they do in this kingdom that they get to stay in if they obey. And it's horrible. Joshua's got some successes in it because all thanks to God. But as soon as God puts them in the land, they spin out of control. And their sin is so grotesque you can barely even keep reading. And it goes on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And finally God says, all right, enough. I put you in exile. Now I'm going to send you back through a leader named Joshua, which means Jesus. Not the same one who's coming in a few hundred years, but it should show you that you had no chance to be here. And when I sent my judgment and destroyed most of the people, but saved a few in a remnant to be brought home by a man named Jesus, that should show you a picture of what's going to happen to everybody. You have no chance of staying in this land by your own works. And there is going to be a judgment one day at the end of all things. And it should come on everybody. But I'm going to keep a remnant that's going to be saved from that judgment. And a man named Jesus is going to be the reason why they're going to be brought home to their ultimate promised land someday. But they missed that point. They thought, no, I can remain in God's kingdom by what I do. So don't tell me I can't. Moses has the formula I need to follow, and I'm going to do it. And if you say I can't, I'll kill you. I don't care what miraculous signs you do. I'm going to choose to close my eyes to those things and chalk them up to some other power, even Satan if I have to, because I don't want to hear your message. And what we see in this passage is what John has said throughout. They couldn't bear Christ's words. Not that they couldn't understand it. They couldn't bear it. They couldn't take it because they hated what he said. And before you let yourself, as my old self will do, turn into an anti-Semite and say, man, I'm glad I know those Jews. Glad we're a lot smarter than they are. Please know. The reason we love to be right, the reason we love to point out the flaws of others, the reason we love to count how good we are in our own hearts is because our old selves are just as blind as we see here. And they covet that kind of self-righteousness. They covet that kind of earning things before God. And they love to keep track of others' failings so we can feel better than them. This dies hard. And the reason we think that we can't let it go is because we still think that if I do the right thing, maybe God will give me that thing I want. If I just perform well here, if I just turn down this temptation, then this other thing I've been praying about, maybe that has to be put God in my debt. And we act like a bunch of pagans living in karma. Instead of living under a God who is sovereign, who has every right to have taken our lives, but has instead said, but I took it for you. I took that death penalty for you. I don't have any anger left for you. I gave you sight when you were blind so you could see this truth, and I'll never let you close your eyes again to it. Nor can anybody else take that sight, that vision away. But all the ultimate gifts you get are in the future. Now you have the guaranteed promise of them, and the joy that comes from knowing you won't be cast out. And the joy that comes from knowing God still loves you as much as he loves Christ, no matter how bad you fail. But we, like Israel in the desert, get tired of the manna from heaven and contemplate living under slavery so we could have some onions back in Egypt because we're ungrateful. But that generation did enter the promised land. That younger generation did. And our entrance is guaranteed just like theirs, not because of us, but because of what has been done for us. And so when Christ says here at the end, I came for judgment, that those who do not see may see, and those who may see, or those who see may become blind, that might strike you as odd because he said, hey, numerous times, I didn't come to condemn. I didn't come to judge. And he's saying here, I have come to judge. He's not being contradictory, and John's not being a sloppy writer here. His point is, when I said I did not come into the world to condemn it, that's true. I did not come here to say, by the way, everybody, you've all sinned and you're going to hell. I'll see you later. He's not doing that. His main point is to say, I came to provide a way out. I will take God's judgment for you. I will live perfectly for you and give you credit like you did it. I'll die and defeat sin and death and give you new life, which will never be extinguished. You can live with me and my Father in heaven forever. That's my mission. However, there's a flip side to it. Those who do reject that and think they don't need it, I am the one announcing to you that there is judgment for those who go that route. And it's not the one I want. That's why I weep over those who are going to take that option. But what he says is, I came so that those who are blind, who recognize their need, who want sight, can receive it. And those who hear it and spit upon my offer, the consequences are your blindness deepens. So think of the blindness of Bartimaeus from Mark 10. That's the kind of blindness he's talking that he came to save. The one that reaches out and says, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. That kind of blindness is given sight. But these Pharisees say, oh, are we blind? As you picture them snickering to each other, he says, yes, you are, and it's going to get worse if you keep this up. And none of us can say, oh, so-and-so, oh, they're blind beyond God's salvation. Please don't give yourself the power to make judgments like that. Because we know that even Pharisees after this did believe. But as a general rule, this passage is saying to the Israelites more than anyone else, blindness is coming for those who don't believe. So believe while you can. The flip side, we don't have a blindness prophesied for America, though we sure see plenty of it, and we see enough in our own lives. But the desperation comes when we don't know how many days we have or the Lord has. We don't know his plans. So we can't afford to treat the gospel we proclaim to this world as though it can be a light thing to be taken up if they feel like it. You're not given the authority of an Old Testament prophet to proclaim gloom and doom on people, though you hear enough about it on TV. The desperation comes from first being so grateful that in the midst of our blindness, a blindness that did reject him, he came and said, I know you're my enemy right now, and I am going to die your traitor's death for you anyway. And your life is nothing to reflect on positively thus far. It's okay. My life was perfect. I give it to you. It's your property now, your inheritance now. Based on that, I'm adopting you as my child and my heir. Get this message out in response to my grace so others can hear of this hope in the midst of a world that is falling apart. The big picture here is what? All of us were blind from birth, spiritually, every one of us. And all of us who believe are only believers because he came to us and said, receive sight. None of us deserved it. But here we are, heirs of this kingdom that we used to oppose. And this message is one that fills us with such joy that our sight needs to be evident to those who are blind. And by God's grace, we pray that he will give them that sight as well.